is the Hashtag STRask podcast with Amy Hall and Greg Kokel. We're here with you from Stand to Reason, and we're here to answer your questions from Twitter.
Right.
I was just waiting for you to have a nice little quip back at me, Greg, and
there it was.
All right.
One word.
Think McFly asks, when talking to skeptics about what evidence would convince them of God's existence, what's a good response when they say, I'm not sure what would convince me, but if there is an omnipotent being out there, he, she, it would know better than me?
Well, I'm pausing because that's such an odd response. Of course, he, she, it, if there is such a being, would know better than any of us. But what does that have to do with anything pertaining to our knowledge? That's like saying, how do you get from here to Tucumcari, New Mexico? And I say, well, I don't know, but if there is an omnipresent, blah, 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 God, he, she, it, he would know. Well, yeah, he would know. But what is that? I don't get it. So, I mean, that maybe that's something somebody had actually asked them. McFly has a friend that he shared some ideas with. They rejected it. And he says, well, what would convince you? And the person said, I don't know, but God knows if he exists, if he, she, it exists. Well, I'm not sure I understand the point there. And maybe this is the question that McFly should be asking his friend. What are you getting at with that? That's a, what do you mean by that? What are you getting at? Are you saying that if there is a God, then God knows what will convince me and he'll get that information to me? Is that what he means? Or is it just kind of a shrug off and whatever, guess God knows, I don't know what would convince me. I think it is entirely fair for somebody who's a skeptic to say, you know what, I don't know what would convince me. But then you can move into another area and say, okay, think about things that were maybe hard to believe in the past that you now believe to be so. What convinced you in those cases? I think what people might be thinking when pressed on these issues is that no one can know anything about spiritual things. How could I be convinced that there is a God when that kind of knowledge is not even available to us? Because after all, it's spiritual stuff. It's not scientific stuff. Scientific stuff, I could tell you, well, there's empirical evidence. But God, there's no empirical evidence for God, so they think. And so consequently, who could say? And it might be just that sense of a shrug of the shoulders because the person has no idea how one might go about demonstrating the existence of a non-physical being. This gets you back to the so-called flying spaghetti monster challenge. And this is where I think it's helpful to say, well, wait a minute, let me ask you a couple questions. And this is a little sequence that I do with people, and I teach it in Tactics. It's in the new Tactics book, I think, and coming out November 26th. And I've done this at universities like University of Toronto, but I ask a question, do you think things exist? Well, of course they do. Okay, good. Do you think that the things that do exist have always existed? So that's really a question about the eternality of the universe. Well, no, I think they all came into being. Like when? The Big Bang. Okay, I'm with you there. All right, fine. Okay, here's the last question. What caused the everything to come into existence? What banged the Big Bang, kind of? Now, there's only two options, either something or no thing. Something or no thing. Now, of course, some people might think it's possible for everything to come out of nothing, no thing, but it's not the odds-on favorite, all right? So there's a simple little series of questions that help us to see that we could rationally, based on our simple awareness of cause and effect relationships, that effects have causes adequate to them, could conclude reasonably that there must have been something outside of the universe that was adequate to cause the universe. Now, the reason I bring this up, what I offered is just a kind of a down-home version of the Kalam cosmological argument, is simply to show that we can, in a sense, reflect and reasonably come to a conclusion that there is a non-material being who is responsible for the material world. So it's not so far out of our access as some people think, simply because they can't perceive it with their five senses. We have more senses than the five senses. We just have five senses that relate to empirical things. Our other senses are senses we were just using, our rational sense, our reflective ability to work through that issue. So I guess the problem here is it's unclear what the person is claiming, but if they're offering this kind of shrug, well, who could know that kind of stuff? I don't know what that kind of stuff. Well, here's an example of how you could know some of those things, and there may be more lines of thinking like I just offered that might reveal more about the existence of an immaterial realm and things in it.
What strikes me about this question, and just to repeat it, or not the question, but the skeptic's response, I'm not sure what would convince me, but if there is an omnipotent being out there, he would know better than me. What strikes me about this is this idea that God owes it to him. That God owes it to him to prove himself, as if he's, as if this guy's doing God a favor by listening and considering it. And I think it might be worth pointing out.
That's how you read the question.
That's, you know, well, he could show me if he really wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if it were me, one thing I might say is, you know, it sounds like you think God owes you to prove himself. You know what? He doesn't. You could go on your way and be punished, and he would be completely just to do that. So if you want to ignore all these things and not think about it, then that's up to you. But God is not, does not owe you anything. So if you can get that idea across, because it sounds like he's blaming God for the fact that he doesn't believe in God.
It could be, yeah. It's, to me, it's a little ambiguous, but I think that's a point.
Okay, here's a question from Xander Doyle. How would you respond to someone who claims the statistics used to support intelligent design are only subjectively significant? Is the reason we are impressed because we value this outcome more than a universe that does not support life?
Well, I'm not sure I understand this point. The statistics used to point to intelligent design are only what? Subjective?
So, in other words, we're only impressed because we happen to care about, like, my guess is what he's saying is, okay, there's all these, the chances of this world happening are whatever, in whatever, but we only think that's significant because
we care about it,
about this particular result.
When we get questions like this, it's like the last one, I'm a little bit flummoxed as to what point is being made here. I know the point in this case, well, it's because you subjectively care. What difference does that make in terms of the... This is kind of like saying, okay, so this is actually an illustration that the British philosopher...
John Lennox?
No, older...
You got to give me more clues.
Oh, I can't think of his name right now, but I'll probably think of it. The Evolution of the Soul, for example, in his book. Anyway, so he gives a response to the kind of the multiverse notion or whatever. So he's a very eminent British philosopher, theist.
I can picture him in my mind. Yeah. I can't think of his name. I can't believe it.
I met him in a elevator once. Not that that's significant, but in any event, we'll think of it in a minute. John.
Keep going. I'll think of it. Keep going.
No, she's going to her iPhone right now, just so everybody knows. Anyway, here's what he said. He said, if you, Swinburne, yeah, that's how you, there you go. Thank you. That was from Brooke. Good job. But she used her iPhone, too, so there you go.
You don't have to reveal
Richard
all our
Swinburne
secrets.
Richard Swinburne used a variation of this to make a point about the multiverse, but this response that I read is kind of like a guy who's standing there in front of a firing squad, and he's got 100 rifles pointed at him from 15 feet away, and everyone pulls the trigger on command, and none of the bullets hit him. And he concludes... Well, that's because nobody was aiming accurately. They were trying not to hit me. And someone says, oh, no, you're only saying that because you subjectively care about this situation. Well, whether he cared or he didn't has no bearing on the legitimacy of the observation statistically that was just made. I mean, one person might be thinking about his girlfriend or something and pull the trigger at the wrong time or be aiming too high or whatever because he's not paying attention, but not 100 at point-blank range. In that situation, that was design. They were designed not to hit him. That's the common sense reply, regardless of whatever subjective interest the person who is now not dead had in being not dead. That's the way this kind of comment strikes me. It's lame. All right.
Well, one thing, I think this was in William Lane Craig's book, On Guard, where he made the point that it's not that there's all these different possible universes and ours is as equally likely as any other one. It's that there are all these other ones that are not life supporting versus the few, if, you know, I don't know how many are life supporting. So it's not like one versus one of, you know, I don't know if this is really hard to explain over just speaking.
Well, with multiverse, you've got an infinite number anyway, is what they often talk about. So that's how they get it to work their direction. They posit the infinite number, and I don't know if that helps you. But
I don't know if it does either. But anyway, the idea was just that it's not just that there's equally likely all these different ones. It's that all of these different ones that are not life-supporting versus the one that is. Mm-hmm. So the chances of getting the one that is a very low chance.
It's infinitesimally small. It's impossibly small. Yeah, so
okay, and then it happens to be the one that's meaningful, you know?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, some people are not going to be persuaded by just about anything. And I think a lot of these rejoinders to the design argument are so obviously unreasonable that it demonstrates how committed the person using these rejoinders is to not believing no matter what. That's what I think it shows.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question from Daryl Hall, not a relation. So he's not getting
okay.
So he asks, how can an omniscient creator God, who by definition can learn no new information, have a satisfying personal relationship with his creations, already knowing their end from the beginnings?
Okay, well, my question for him would be, what exactly is the problem? Tell me why the relationships would not be satisfying because God knows what's going to happen. How would that take the satisfaction out of it? He would need to explain that to me because he's presuming that if you know what's going to happen, then the relationship couldn't be satisfying. So to counter that, since I don't have him here, I don't know what that is, but I'm just going to suggest let people think about relationships they have that are satisfying. Isn't it true in a lot of cases that the satisfaction is just being together? It isn't like I enjoy being with Amy, and I don't enjoy being with Amy because I don't know what she's going to do next. Who knows what's going to happen? I'm waiting. No, it's just because I like Amy. She's just nice to hang with. And every once in a while, she does something interesting, but that's not the reason. That's not the reason I like her. So, I mean, when you think about the nature of relationships, there's deep satisfaction in the being together element that is irrelevant, for which omniscience is irrelevant. And so that's why I don't see how omniscience is going to somehow remove the satisfaction that would be part of a relationship. Mm-hmm. So I don't get it.
I have nothing to add.
Okay. Because you're so wonderful to be with.
But you didn't know I was going to say that.
You don't even have to add anything. You're just there.
Okay, here's a question from Justin Robichaud. Is it biblical to fast by not eating for a period of time in order to get guidance from the Lord in terms of seeking my next career move? I had some friends suggest that to me. Just wanted to get your input on that. Or should I be doing that at all?
Well, my response is that the fasting is to an end that is not biblically sound. It's not a sin or anything like that. But what it does is it presumes that when it comes to things like this, my next career move, that what we have to do is we've got to get God to tell us what it is he wants us to do. And sometimes we don't hear from him, and so we've got to find a way to twist his arm so he tells us. And fasting is a way, in a certain sense, to twist his arm, to tell us. Now, I do think fasting could be construed as a way of kind of twisting God's arm, if what you mean is you're going through some discipline to move God to some end. The question is the end you're moving God to, and there is no biblical reason to think that the way we decide things in our lives, what's next, whether it's a career move or whether it's a ministry move or whether it's a relationship move like marriage, is that we have to have God tell us. And if God hasn't told us, well, then by golly, we'll find some trick to get him to tell us. If God is not committed to speaking, to telling us those kinds of things, and I'm convinced that's the case, God has not committed himself to making decisions for us, then it doesn't matter what we're going to do. We're not going to squeeze that out of him. Now, it may be that certain types of prayer and persistence in prayer will persuade him to do something else. But in this case, to have him tell you what to do when he wants you to make the decision in a godly way yourself, then this is not going to be a legitimate means to that. Now, of course, this hinges on my own understanding of the New Testament teaching about decision-making. And I speak on this regularly on the air, and I've written on it quite a bit, and people can get our training on that called Decision-Making in the Will of God, so if they want the details. But the long and short of it is, it's a mistake to presume that God makes our decisions for us and then gives us little hints about what he wants us to do. And therefore, if you haven't gotten enough hints about a career move, the best way to get God to act is to pray and fast. Pray and fasting regarding a career move may be legitimate if what you're looking to do is to make a wise choice and focus and get your head on straight regarding these things. There's a spiritual element to that, so I'm not discouraging praying and fasting. But if what you're doing is you're praying and fasting with the goal of having God tell you essentially what career move to make, I don't think God's going to do that.
Yeah, you just touched on what I was going to bring up, because I don't think this necessarily, that fasting has to be, I'm looking for a sign from God or an answer from God. I think it's perfectly legitimate to say, I'm going to humble myself before God and pray for wisdom, because obviously we're told to pray for wisdom. And as long as you understand wisdom to be that you'll see all the factors involved, that you'll understand what God's word says about the moral aspects of this, you'll make a wise decision. I think that's perfectly legitimate, as long as you're not looking for a sign or something
right.
like
for
that.
For God to tell you what to do. This
right.
is what
yeah.
God wants you to do. That is a completely misguided approach to decision-making. And frankly, you will find almost no hint of that in the entire New Testament. It just isn't there. And they're very, very well. Anyway, I don't want to go into that because we'll spend all day talking about it. But
so, if anyone out there, if you're not familiar with Greg's teaching on this, this might be a surprise to you.
The biblical teaching on this.
Put it that way. Yes, Greg actually has a few articles on our website at str.org. They're called "Does God Whisper?" and there are three parts. And we also have a booklet called "The Ambassador's Guide: Hearing the Voice of God." And we have a book by Gary Friesen called Decision Making and the Will of God.
Right.
So if you
and I have tapes to the,
yes.
by that same title that kind of goes
CDs
through
or MP3s.
That's right, CDs. That's right.
So if this sounds unfamiliar to you, Greg will go through all of the the biblical reasons why he holds to a wisdom model, and I do too, a wisdom model rather than a signs and directions from God model.
Right. And there's also the book by Kevin DeYoung, Just Do mm-hmm. Something, and he speaks of that as well. And I was kind of poking fun with Amy a moment ago. It's not Greg's view. It's the biblical view, and everybody believes theirs is the biblical view. But I realize that the view that I have is across the grain right now as to the way evangelicals in general approach this issue. But it is not across the grain historically. The current methodology for making decisions, kind of squeezing decisions out of God who drops little hints here and there, that is historically new. 150 years, maybe 200 years at the most, according to J.I. Packer. This is not the way the church has normally functioned. You do not find that also in the book of Acts, where you'd expect to see it in spades if that were the way mm-hmm. things were done.
So take a look at our website at str.org, and you'll find a lot more about that. So thank you, everyone, for your questions once again. Keep sending those questions on Twitter with the hashtag SDRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.